Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
While the lawyers take over in a New York City courtroom, the Chrysler bankruptcy is playing out in real life. We're going to get some slices of that life on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice, over 10,000 independent insurance agencies across America committed to treating customers as people, not policies. Online at trustedchoice.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 1st of May today. And now that the lawyers have taken over, the Chrysler bankruptcy story is going to devolve into a discussion of motions and if it pleases the court. But what happens in that courtroom is going to have some very real impact down the corporate food chain. For workers, of course, suppliers, and where the rubber meets the road, if you'll pardon the pun, the dealerships and the people who might still be buying Chrysler products. We sent Tamara Keith to one of those dealerships outside Washington, D.C. to see how it's going for them and their customers so far.
Salesmen at Darcars Chrysler Jeep in Rockville, Maryland, are used to customers asking if they're closing. And they tell them,
we don't anticipate going anywhere. We anticipate only better times.
That's General Manager John Stakem. He says Chrysler's bankruptcy has thankfully ended the uncertainty. And Chrysler cars come with a lifetime powertrain warranty.
Chrysler will be backing that warranty because we're going to come out of this very, very well. But in addition to that, the federal government has said that they'll back these warranties as well.
I was expecting the showroom to feel like the lobby of a mortuary, but it's not. Several people trickle in on a Friday afternoon. George and Ruby Sherwood are looking to replace their 12-year-old Grand Cherokee.
It's been really wonderful.
Sales associate Ralph Bowen is showing them a Jeep Liberty Sport.
Why are you here? Would you like to take one for a test drive?
No, we don't have time.
Oh, okay. When you
but
do, please come back.
If the price is right, we'll certainly...
We'll make it right for you.
But doesn't the bankruptcy bother the Sherwoods?
No.
It did me. That's why I want to try to find a car before they totally fold everything.
Ruby Sherwood really wants to get that Jeep before Chrysler disappears or Fiat gets its hands on it.
So you hang around so we can come back and
I'll
find you.
I'll be here. Okay. I promise.
In Rockville, Maryland, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
As news of the bankruptcy developed yesterday, we got on the phone with Mickey Maynard of the New York Times. We talked about what's next for the company, what the Chrysler filing might eventually mean for General Motors. And I asked her how some of Chrysler's lenders might be able to get their money back. Here's what she said.
They can get in front of the judge and say, hi, I'd like to have the Kokomo transmission plant, please.
So we called the mayor of Kokomo. Gary Goodnight is his name, to see how things are going. Mr. Mayor, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Kai. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How's the mood in Kokomo?
Well, we've been going through this for quite a while now, this chapter of Kokomo. We've obviously started last fall with talks of a GM-Chrysler merger. Went through the automotive bridge loan process, and of course, we've been watching since Fiat came into the picture.
Help us understand how important the automotive industry is to Kokomo. I mean, what does it contribute in terms of employment, property tax, all that?
Sure. Well, just to give you a brief description, Kokomo is about 50,000 people, 45 miles directly north of Indianapolis. We currently have about 5,000 employees at Chrysler and probably another 3,000 or so at Delphi Electronics, which used to be a division of General Motors. You know, obviously, Chrysler is extremely important to Kokomo. It is the largest payer of property taxes, which go to the city, the county government, school system, things like that.
While you'd probably rather not think about this, could this be this entire evolution with the automotive industry? Could it be an opportunity to diversify the Kokomo economy?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to do this. And we had started down that path. I was the first mayor in the state to come out with the Green Jobs Initiative. We have done some things. We have an Indiana University campus in Kokomo. We have a large Ivy Tech facility, which is the state's largest technical school. So we've tried to do some of those things, go in a different direction. and we're still trying to do that, but I think it's important to stabilize things that we hold on to our base, which is, of course, Chrysler.
When you go out to dinner at a local restaurant or hold your Meet the Mayor sessions on Saturday morning or whenever you do them, what are you hearing from constituents about how confident they are that they and your city is going to be able to bounce back?
When I talk with people, I remind them that, you know, we've been through these times before. They understand that. People in Kokomo are good at weathering these times. And I think, you know, we believe that we have something to offer this country. Because of those automotive facilities, it's not just factory workers. We have a huge number of engineers, technicians. A lot of patents come from Kokomo, from Delphi and Chrysler and Haynes International, one of our other employers. You know, we're bracing ourselves for this whole ordeal, but the fact that it's a structured bankruptcy with all the players in line going into it, we feel very confident that Chrysler's going to be intact and hopefully on the road to success here in the next 60 days.
Greg Goodnight, he's the mayor of Kokomo, Indiana. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Today is May Day, also known as International Workers' Day. It's honored mostly in the breach in this country. But tens of thousands of people in many cities, including Los Angeles, did rally today for immigrants' rights.
Obama, escucha, estamos en la lucha. Obama, escucha.
So we can work and have a better place to live. We're just going working for a better life.
They're out there on the streets working for this country, you know, and we need to legalize all these people.
That's basically why we're out here. We're from El Paso, Texas, so we made the drive out here and trying to support as much as possible.
After years of slow progress, they had something to celebrate. This week, the Obama administration announced it's changing its immigration enforcement policy. Instead of going after undocumented workers, it'll be targeting employers instead. From the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN in Miami, Dan Gretsch reports.
Immigration enforcement in recent years has largely meant SWAT-style raids. The raids broke up families and crippled businesses. They've become increasingly unpopular. So the Department of Homeland Security will now focus on the root cause of illegal immigration, jobs. Tamar Jacoby is president of Immigration Works USA.
The plan here is to go after the unscrupulous employers, right? The ones who are deliberately breaking the law, exploiting workers, top management that has relationships with smuggling rings and document forgers and that sort of thing.
Jacoby says employers once feared immigration officials tightening the noose of enforcement. No more.
Businesses are realizing more and more that restoring the rule of law in the workplace will be good for them. That it doesn't make sense to be investing either your family fortune or your brand name in a business that's standing on shaky ground legally.
Immigrant advocates emphasize that going after bad apple employers still impacts undocumented workers and their families. Eric Kamide Fresas is a professor at Florida International University.
When you go after the sources of work, the job magnets, you're really going after the sources of food.
There are an estimated 7 million undocumented workers in the U.S. Experts say enforcement alone won't do much to dent that number. President Obama has pledged to take up comprehensive immigration reform later this year. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
A correction from the broadcast yesterday. I set up our story on Disney buying a chunk of the video streaming site Hulu.com by misidentifying the companies that own that website. At the moment, it's owned by NBC Universal and News Corp. There was some pride of ownership on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From New York City today, some fresh evidence that the bad economy is hitting the high end, too. Henry Bendel announced it's going to stop selling clothing at its flagship store on Fifth Avenue this summer. What's that? You say you've never heard of Bendel's? Me neither, until our morning meeting today. So clearly you and I haven't been watching enough Gossip Girl, but apparently those $3,000 prom dresses just aren't selling as well these days. Luxury retailers have been cutting costs and laying off staff, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Starting this summer, Bendel's devotees will have to buy their $200 jeans and peasant tops elsewhere. The legendary boutique is closing its third floor and focusing on makeup and accessories. Outside the flagship today, I found Christine Lohmuller wearing two shirts from Bendel's. She's a student in fashion school.
I only get to go shopping here when my mom comes, but...
Jewelry designer Marsha Chun Matsubara was unfazed.
They're only known for makeup and accessories. I don't ever look at clothes. I didn't even think they sold clothes.
No rebranding necessary there. The real problem for luxury stores is too few luxury shoppers. Retail strategist Candice Corlett.
When we were in the mood to go out and just shop and buy everything that caught our eye, that's where you'd go. But now we've become a lot more restrained. And Bendel's is a store of lots of indulgences.
In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You need jewels to go along with all those fancy clothes Bendel's used to sell. There is, though, a tendency to cut back on the bling when the economy's sour. The $65 billion global diamond industry has been hit pretty hard. Prices have fallen by a third since last August, and that has taken the sparkle out of a lot of the economies where diamonds are mined. De Beers, the world's biggest diamond producer, announced this week its output is down 91%, which means it's also bad news for India, where almost three-quarters of the world's diamonds are cut and polished. Raymond Thibodeau reports.
The city of Surat in western India is the heart of the country's diamond industry. Its highly skilled and relatively cheap workforce has made India number one in the diamond processing business. In Surat's diamond market, buyers and tourists usually swarm the narrow streets, hunting for deals in hundreds of ramshackle mom-and-pop diamond shops. But these days, many of the shops have closed. So have the factories that cut and polish the rough diamonds. Analysts say Surat's revenue from the diamond industry is expected to fall by a quarter this year. K.K. Sharma is executive director of the Surat Diamond Institute.
Everything started with the economic crisis in the United States. The first industry affected was the luxury industry, and since diamond is a luxury item, it was hurt the most.
Sharma says many diamond merchants are having trouble paying their suppliers.
A lot of people defaulted in their payment terms, and because of that, the Indian manufacturers were in a liquidity crunch. With heavy stocks, with no money, with no fresh orders, they had to close down their units.
They also had to lay off more than 200,000 people, more than half the industry's workforce. India's diamond trade lifted millions of Indian families out of poverty, but it's an escape route no more.
Now they are no work.
Diamond trader Kanu Balar says he's never seen so many workers so desperate for jobs.
There were problems. After in 3-4 months, many people are suicide because of the problem.
If you lose your job in this one-time boom town, you still have to cope with the high cost of living here for housing and health care and school fees. Authorities say that since the industry crisis began, more than 70 laid-off diamond workers have committed suicide. That's Pushpa Yadav, whose husband Kopesh was laid off in October after 9 years as a diamond polisher for one of India's biggest diamond exporters.
We were doing good until Kalpesh lost his job. For us, everything changed after that.
Pushpa says her husband couldn't find other work. Their savings dwindled, the debts piled up. And 3 months after he was laid off, Kopesh drowned himself in the Tapi River that loops around this so-called diamond city. Diamond industry leaders here say such tragedies are part of the human cost of the global economic crisis. They're calling on the Indian government to bail out the industry, and to do it soon. In Surat, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
The president made it through his first 100 days in office. Swine flu grabbed almost as many headlines as that did. Chrysler went bankrupt. We talked to the mayor of Kokomo about that. Other than that, though, kind of a slow week. Joining us for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond is Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon from Reuters. Hello again, you two.
Good to be here.
So obviously, from the mayor of Kokomo's perspective, Chrysler going bankrupt is not necessarily the best thing in the world. But Felix, from a pure corporate perspective, just a business model aspect, it's not terrible, right?
It's actually quite a good thing, because the big millstone around Chrysler's neck, the big problem which they have whenever they try to make big changes, is not so much the union as the dealer network. The dealers have these enormous contracts and have a lot of power in the municipalities in which they're based. And if Chrysler wants to bring down its dealer network to something commensurate with the size that it's going to be going forwards, going into bankruptcy is by far the best way to get out of those contracts without having to pay billions of dollars to the dealers.
All right, but Lee, will it work? Will we have a new, smaller, braver, better Chrysler?
We invariably will. You know, Chrysler is going to enter into this partnership with Fiat. They're going to dramatically downsize. And Felix is right. I mean, this is what a bankruptcy allows you to do. It allows you to take the time, clear everything out. It will be leaner. There's actually an argument to be made that this should have happened well before now, before the government poured another $4 billion into the company, you know, over the past several months. But if you think about it, Chrysler had actually really cleaned itself up in recent years, but then things really deteriorated, and this is probably the only option.
Felix, what about these bondholders that the president came down on pretty hard yesterday? I mean, they are, you know, entitled to what they're owed, no?
No, they're entitled to nothing, really, because Chrysler isn't worth anything right now. That's the problem. They talk about how much it might be worth in liquidation, but Chrysler isn't going to be liquidated. They knew that when they bought their bonds, because the government has always made it eminently clear that it won't allow Detroit to just simply be liquidated. It would cost the government too much, for starters, just in terms of unemployment benefits and that kind of thing. So they are being offered $2.25 billion by the government, cash, for their bonds, and that's a pretty good deal, and I think they should take it.
Lee, what do you think?
Well, I think there's an interesting dynamic happening here. I think that this isn't so much about the money. Of course, it's a lot of money, but I think this is just as much a stand on principle by the bondholders. They firmly believe that they do not need to make sacrifices to save Chrysler, and they're reverting to the argument that, you know, the bankruptcy code calls for the secured creditors to be first in line, and this plan is not honoring that. And, you know, the argument they're making is that some of the big banks that are also secured creditors who did agree to these terms agreed because they're taking TARP money and they need to be a little more agreeable with the government's term. So I think they do have a point.
Speak now if you believe this is going to be over in 30 to 60 days. Okay, moving on.
Silence.
There we go. Moving on to the next topic today. Gross domestic product. A negative 6.1% we learned earlier. Nobody's really surprised. Any good signs at all, Lee?
Well, I think there are some signs that things are not getting as bad as fast. But I also think that we still have a lot of headwinds. This unprecedented bankruptcy with Chrysler, even just the swine flu this week. I mean, this market really seems to be a sort of see no evil, hear no evil market. And it does seem a little suspicious that this bull market is going to keep going up and up from here.
Let me throw another one at you, Felix. The stress test that we were supposed to get on Monday, now not coming till Thursday. Good sign or bad sign?
Well, it's actually a mixed signal. I think it means that the government and the banks haven't come to an agreement on what they're going to do about the results of these tests. But it also means that they're being sensible about that fact, and rather than just release the results of the tests in the face of an inability to resolve the issues thrown up by them, they're sitting down and they're taking their time and they're not giving themselves artificial deadlines, and they're allowing the banks and the government and Treasury time to work out exactly how these institutions are going to be recapitalized. So in that sense, it's a good sign, so long as we do get something constructive when the stress tests are released.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon at Reuters. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Cheers, guy.
Coming up, overseas workers deal with the downturn.
The conference calls usually start about 8 o'clock at night and sometimes go till 11, 12 at night. So, you know, you're working at least a day and a half each day.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 44 points today, 0.5%, closed at 82.12. The NASDAQ bumped up 1 point. That is 0.1%. Ended the day and the week at 17.19. The S&P 500 climbed 4 points, 0.5%, finished at 877. For the week, another good one. The Dow put on 1.7%. The NASDAQ continued its winning streak, up 1.5%. The S&P 500 rose 1.3%. Financials were mixed today, though. Citigroup and Bank of America both dropped more than 2.5% apiece. Morgan Stanley tacked on 9%. Continued concerns about car sales drove Ford down nearly 5%. General Motors slid 5.75%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.15%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for March. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly index of pending home sales. And Wind Power 2009 gets underway in Chicago. It's billed as the largest annual wind conference in the world. Over 15,000 attendees are expected in the Windy City. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Yes, I realize school's not even out yet, but still, summer is upon us. How do we know? Because Hollywood says so. The summer movie season starts today with the latest installment of the X-Men franchise. It could give Hollywood some idea of what the Great Recession has in store for it, because as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, there are a lot of potential blockbusters on the way.
X-Men is what's known in Hollywood as a tentpole movie. If you've never heard of that, here's entertainment industry analyst Hal Vogel.
Just as you would outside on a lawn, you have a tentpole and it supports presumably the rest of the tent.
The blockbuster films are the tentpoles, and there could be a lot this year. This month alone, Angels and Demons and Star Trek will hit theaters.
The film really has to lead the box office by a wide margin in order to do what it's supposed to do.
What it's supposed to do is make so much money that it pays for itself, that's at least $100 million, and helps cover the rest of the studio's productions, especially the flops. Our own unscientific survey in New York's Times Square indicates this weekend's tentpole should stand up. Moviegoers were practically unanimous.
We're going to see X-Men tonight.
X-Men. I'm here to see X-Men Wolverine, and I'm hyped for it because I love Wolverine and I love the X-Men.
You get the picture. And the idea is that all those people will be tempted by trailers and come back.
Movie going breeds movie going.
Patrick Corcoran is with the National Association of Theater Owners. He says there is one drawback to so many big movies. They push each other out of the theaters too fast. Studios learned that lesson two summers ago.
After the summer was over, a lot of studio executives were, you know, willing to say that they'd left a couple of $100 million behind because the marketplace was so crowded.
In other words, it pays to spread the tent poles out. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
For a lot of companies, the key to surviving this recession is pretty simple. Spend less. So travel expenses are getting another look. Marketing budgets are being trimmed. Labor costs are under the microscope, too. For multinational companies, that can mean pulling their expensive overseas employees back home. And it makes sense. Expat packages don't come cheap. But that doesn't mean it's easy for the workers in question or for their families. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Jeff McCain was just getting good at China. He'd negotiated a multimillion-dollar contract for his company. His wife and kids were learning Chinese. And he was about to rent a bigger house in Shanghai. Then,
the day before we were to sign for our lease, my boss called from the U.S. and said, don't sign that lease because we don't know what's going on. You know, we're trying to cut costs.
McCain is a manager for a major auto supplier headquartered in Detroit. He visits factories in China and negotiates with customers and suppliers. On top of his salary, his company forks out some $20,000 a year so his son can attend international school. And another $60,000 for his family's annual housing. Typical corporate package, but times are not typical, so Jeff is getting yanked and replaced by a cheaper model.
A lot of the multinationals are looking at, hey, can we bring over single people or people that don't have school expenses?
It was shocking and we were angry.
That's Jeff's wife, Debbie McCain. She doesn't want to leave China. which is interesting because 2 years ago, she didn't want to come.
I still remember the day Jeff left for work saying that he was going in to sign the contract. And I was crying the whole morning as he was walking out the garage.
Something changed. The McCains adjusted. Many of the 27,000 Americans in Shanghai will tell you it comes in stages, beginning with panic.
The day before the movers came, I found out I was pregnant with our second son.
When they got to Shanghai, Jeff found himself in an unfamiliar business culture. As an automotive supplier, he was used to American customers focusing on product quality and price. Here, it's almost all about price.
They're more willing to compromise on features. We'll use a cheaper grade of steel. And maybe it won't last as long, but that's okay.
And Jeff had to adjust to much longer work days. Every night, he gets home around 6:30, plays with the boys, wolfs down some dinner, and gets on the phone. His colleagues in Detroit are just waking up.
The conference calls usually start about 8 o'clock at night and sometimes go till 11, 12 at night. So, you know, you're working at least a day and a half each day. There's really no off time. There's times I've woken up in the middle of a conference call thinking, oh, what did I miss? I hope nobody asked me a question.
Over time, the McCains learned to thrive in China. Jeff found the expat softball league. Debbie found the grocery store that sells cheddar cheese and Captain Crunch. And they sharpen their elbows, the better to survive in crowded Shanghai.
There's times I get frustrated, I just push.
You're just kind of elbow around?
I just take my front arm and just kind of shove them out of the way.
Well, the strollers work good for that, too.
With the McCains hitting their stride, they felt blindsided when headquarters ordered them back. Now they will return to Michigan, and Jeff doesn't know what job he'll be doing. He also frets about the work he'll be leaving behind. His company just built a transmission factory here in China. China is a long-term investment for corporate America. But McCain's employer is in short-term survival mode. So for Jeff McCain and his family, the immediate future is clear.
We gotta go.
In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note on the widening economic impact of swine flu. To cruise lines, you can now add airlines. Continental Airlines sells more seats going to Mexico than any other U.S. carrier, 450 flights a week at the moment. Starting Monday, that capacity is going to be cut in half. Houston-based Continental said it's either going to use smaller planes or just cut out some flights entirely. CEO Larry Kellner did say overall, though, that business was already weak, and he's not expecting a huge hit to his company's bottom line. That is Marketplace this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 44 points, a half percent. The NASDAQ added 1 point, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 rose 4 points. Call that about a half percent there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, German universities hike tuition to raise the bar.
What we have to learn from the American system is competition. Competition is the number one thing to have to become successful.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.